Welcome to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. Dr. Danielle Ofri has written a book of great clinical interest. It's called What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. It will be published in early February by Beacon Press. It's about conversations and how best to conduct them. It's for not only clinicians but patients as well, because she believes that conversations are things constructed by both parties. Dr. Ofri is an associate professor of medicine at New York University School of Medicine, and she does clinical work at Bellevue Hospital. She's also the editor of the Bellevue Literary Review. Welcome back to Clinical Conversations, Danielle.
Thank you, Joe.
I'm conscious of the fact that we're having a conversation and that I'm going to try to follow some of the rules that you espouse in your book. But let's start with the title. What patients say, what doctors hear. That's usually studied from the other direction, isn't it? I mean, all the research is about what doctors say and what patients remember.
How the book came to be was that I was writing, in fact, for my previous book, What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. And I had been hoping to write a chapter on doctors and patients as friends outside the office. So I trolled around the internet looking for some articles, and I found a blog post by a doctor talking about becoming a Facebook friend with patients. So I interviewed this doctor, and she mentioned a patient of hers, a lovely young woman, very challenging illness, and, you know, how she tried to become friends with her to help facilitate the care. Anyway, as I later read this doctor's blog, I saw comments on the blog from someone who I guess was probably that patient, who used her real name, was very open. So I asked the doctor if she'd want to be in touch, and the patient was thrilled to talk, so I interviewed the patient. And the story she told was so different than the doctor. They were both very intelligent, thoughtful, self-critical, and yet the stories were almost like two different movies or two different movie cameras on the same scene. Episode didn't make it to the previous book, but I thought that would make an excellent nugget for a book about what patients say, what doctors hear. And that became the story of Dr. Mavromatis and Morgan Amanda in my book.
And you weave that throughout the book.
You
start with it, and the story is woven throughout throughout the chapters. But in doing so, you focus on, okay, so how is it that people in general, clinicians and patients, are communicating, and some of the ways that those communications fail, and some of the ways in which surprising things happen. And you mentioned early on that the conversation between doctor and patient is the most important diagnostic tool in medicine.
I think, particularly for internists, but I think for almost all physicians, if they think critically about their interaction with the patient, really almost everything comes through in the history part. And the physical is usually an adjunct. They're really, it's talking to the patient from which the data is gathered, and then we confirm out with lab tests and imaging studies. And when I look in my own practice, it's really true. And the days that I'm not listening so well, when I'm completely overworked and feeling rushed, I can feel my diagnostic accuracy going down, and I see the patients losing the connection.
Huh.
And the days that I'm a little bit better at it, I feel the success much more.
You described some of the techniques, some general techniques, like, having the doctor shut up or the technique of listening attentively or asking how a disease affects the patient's life. Can you talk a little bit about some of those?
Sure. I mean, a simple one. I mean, when patients talk, we jump in so quickly. And we always hear that, number 12 seconds, 10 seconds. It seems appalling, but in fact, that's true. The patient says, I have stomach pain. I say, oh, when does it happen? Show me where it is. How long does it last? Right in before they've really, said their whole piece. And, in fact, if you let a patient talk sort of uninterrupted, most of them will stop within a minute or two. They'll kind of get the whole thing out, and then you can ask the questions. And I think that serves a number of purposes. One is that what the patient says in the first few words may not be the most important thing or the key to the visit. Second, it's an investment in the bank in the doctor-patient connection. 1 minute of focused, attentive listening is enormous. If you've ever spoken to someone who looks straight in your eyes and doesn't say a word, a minute is a very long time, which you feel incredibly listened to and respected.
True.
And after that, if you need to turn away to the computer, which we all have to do, or you need to cut a visit short, or follow up on the next visit, you will have gained the patient's trust, and that goes a long way toward more accurate diagnosis, and also, I believe, fewer medical errors, because the patient is much more willing to tell you things they might not normally say to, you know, otherwise distracted doctors.
You had an incident in the book you described with somebody to whom you had given written instructions to deal with. I believe it was their high blood pressure or diabetes, and you had done, very carefully written these out, and it turns out that the patient was illiterate.
Right, and he was too embarrassed to admit that. And it took us on the order of years, year or two, till I realized that. And here I was working so hard with these medication lists and doing all the right things for our, the hospital requires for medication reconciliation, but it was meaningless because till I gained his trust that he could admit this very embarrassing secret, and that was the key to his medical care. And I could have learned that earlier had I created a different environment, and we could have attended to his health more effectively much earlier on.
Now, there are techniques of measuring. There's so much else in clinical medicine. You can measure things. And one of the things that you talk about is the rotor interaction analysis system, which is a way of looking at a conversation and seeing how it's characterizing it.
How do we study the doctor-patient conversation? I mean, you need a research tool to do this. And traditionally, people tape the conversation, transcribe the entire thing laboriously, and then try to look at that. And it takes so long, little work could be done. What Deborah Roeder at Johns Hopkins developed was a system in which you could rapidly classify, just by listening, different kinds of statements. And she developed a very extensive categorization. So statements that were information gathering, statements that were offered education, statements that offered reassurance or empathy, and quickly classify them. And so you could see what percentage of a doctor's conversation was spent gathering data, what percentage was doing education, and then compare that with outcomes, blood pressure control, medication adherence, HIV meds, a whole host of things. And she was able to sort of tease out, more effective and less effective ways of communicating.
You mentioned that other research, and you had, I guess you must have spent a lot of time reading the research on these interactions, that the doctor-dominated conversations are not good for the patient. They have clinical implications, and you said that a doctor-dominated conversation led to a threefold higher risk of non-compliance with the blood pressure regimens.
Yes, the more doctors, in almost every doctor-patient conversation, doctors dominate and speak more of the time, but there's a range in how much they dominate. Interestingly, there are racial differences. Doctors dominate more with African-American patients than with Caucasian patients. But the doctors who dominate on the highest end, they had worse compliance with medication and blood pressure control. And there are multiple studies along those lines, partly because a lot of the issues of why a patient isn't getting better, why they're not taking the medications or adhering to their diet or making follow-up appointments, are reasons that the patient knows but doesn't feel comfortable sharing. Such as not being able to read or can't afford the medications or embarrassed about using insulin syringes in public. There's a host of things, a pressure from family about what they're eating or how they're changing. All of these things don't come through if the doctor is simply haranguing the patient, you better take your pills, you'll be, blind and amputated and on dialysis if you don't take your diabetes pills, which is what we tend to do. If we switch our conversations around, perhaps ask, what is the hardest thing about having diabetes? You might learn something, such as, the finger sticks hurt too much, I just won't do it. Yeah. Or the strips aren't covered by my insurance and I can't afford them.
All of that takes time, doesn't it? I mean, if you've got a 15-minute flight time with a patient, anything that you do, you have to be very careful about, am I going to waste 15 seconds? Asking those questions. But as you point out, all of that investment pays back manyfold, doesn't it?
It's also a time saver. With my patient who couldn't read, I wasted 2 years of time.
That's
if it took 5 or 10 minutes on my first visit, to really probe his background, his, quote, social history, that very unimportant part that we always leave to the end, and note up front that he couldn't read, boy, that would have saved time. In fact, since then, I ask every patient how far they've gone in school. And I recognize this could be a sensitive question, so I try to just, you know, how far did you go in school? Do you smoke? Do you drink? Very routinely. And I uncover many of my patients who've immigrated from, say, Central America, who've been to first or third grade total. And so I know then that going forward, I need to be very careful how I, you know, give them educational materials. Conversely, I have taxi drivers who have PhDs in economics from Bangladesh, and so I know that I can, you know, they're functioning at a different intellectual level. So it is worth the investment, because then I find out how I can more accurately gear the information that I'm giving. So it's an incredible time saver, ultimately.
And so the research on this book and the writing of it has it has affected your clinical behavior, has it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I try very hard not to interrupt in the beginning, if at all possible. And I, as I wrote in the book, I found this, in fact, counterintuitively very effective with the polysomatic complaint kind of patient, you know, the one we all hate. The person who has 100 complaints, says yes to everything in the review systems, and these are the patients we want to shut up as quickly as possible, right, because we'll never finish. And so I wrote about one patient who I tried to let her say everything, get it all out, and I didn't touch the computer. I just nodded, anything else, and I took notes. And when she finished speaking, and honestly, I thought an hour had gone by, but it was about 4 minutes. It really wasn't that long. And then she said, I've always heard about this, I never actually heard, she said, I actually feel better having gotten it all out.
Huh.
And that was the remarkable thing. She actually felt better. And you know what? I did too. Because I usually dread her visits. Oh, they're going to take it forever, we'll never get anywhere. But once she told me every last, and I mean every last toe pain and that she had, I had this list, and it was long, but it was finite. And for me, to view her issues as finite rather than infinite made me feel better. And then suddenly, okay, we have a list to work on. We'll hit all 20 today, but we'll do 4 today. You pick 2, I pick 2, and then here's the ones for next time. And suddenly those dreaded chronic pain patients, you know, they get a little bit easier.
Yeah.
And plus, they feel much better. And these are the patients who doctor shop, who overutilize tests. So when she says, you know, I need an MRI, I can say, you know, I don't know if you need that one right now. And she's, I think, more likely to trust me, because we've established this, so I think it is more efficient, ultimately, and I think it does ultimately save money on unnecessary tests.
If you could change one thing in your colleagues' behavior, and I mean, you know, colleagues, all clinicians, not just the ones at Bellevue, what change would you like to see?
I think maybe we all sort of took that oath to not speak for the first minute and let the patient talk and give the full focused contact. I think a lot of patients' dissatisfaction with medicine could be, I'm not going to say eliminated, but could be minimized by just that. Because I think that most patients, their biggest complaints, they don't feel heard or respected.
Huh.
And that little bit of focused, respectful attention really makes a difference. And I could imagine that could shift the needle on patients' overall view of the medical profession. And I suspect, but I can't prove, that would have an impact on malpractice. Because again, most malpractice suits result from communication. Patients didn't get the information they want or felt treated poorly, much more than actual true malpractice. And that kind of behavior, I think, changes how patients view their doctors.
So the book is going to be published on February 7th, and it's called What Patients Say and What Doctors Hear. Is it available? I'll plug it. Is it available for pre-order on Amazon?
Yes, you can pre-order from any bookseller online or even brick and mortar. And in fact, Beacon Press is offering the free first chapter. If you pre-order and forward your receipt through my website, danielleofrey.com, you'll get the first chapter. You can read it right on the spot.
Okay. Well, I would say that it would be time well spent for people to do that. I want to thank you so much for your time with us today, Dr. Ofri.
My pleasure, Joe. Hope we do it again.
That was our 205th edition. All earlier conversations may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. My executive producer is Kristen Kelly. Thank you so much for listening.